Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, I can't believe it. 108 years. Finally, the Cubs broke the curse and clinched the World Series victory. That quest also reminds me of the quest of some of the greatest healthcare breakthroughs. Sometimes it takes decades of toil and sweat and dedication.
Well, Mark, I was just caught up in the moment and the emotion, and I don't even follow baseball, and I was very excited. I think you do have a point. And an analyst at the Bipartisan Policy Center, Sam Waters, actually did a timeline of medical breakthroughs that happened during the Cubs' long drought, starting back in 1908. The game of baseball hasn't changed all that much in all these years, but healthcare certainly has.
No, you're absolutely right. 1916, polio breaks out. 1928, penicillin, the first antibiotic, is discovered. In 1943, the first dialysis machine is fabricated.
Let's not forget 1953, the first heart-lung bypass machine was deployed. 1954, the polio vaccine was discovered. And then 1963, the first artificial heart.
And then 73, the insulin pump. 78, the first MRI. 2003, the human genome is fully sequenced, paving the way for dramatic accelerations of research into human health. Just as the hapless Cubs broke through a long victory drought, I feel we're on the brink of a dramatic new era of victories in medicine and healthcare, driven by some of the breakthroughs and advancements we've talked about, but also the dramatic rise of health information technology. And that's something our guest today is not only passionate about, but a steward of as well.
Dr. Vindell Washington is the National Coordinator for Health IT at the Department of Health and Human Service, facilitating the medical profession's transition from paper records to electronic health records in our new health industry reality.
Lori Robertson also checks in, the managing editor of factcheck.org, always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
No matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Vindell Washington in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Post-surgical infections are a leading cause of death around the world, and World Health Organization is seeking to reduce that threat. Millions of people die each year from infections acquired during surgery. The WHO has issued a new set of guidelines to combat the problem. The Global Guidelines for the Prevention of Surgical Site Infection includes a list of 29 concrete recommendations designed to address the increasing burden of healthcare-associated infections. They range from simple precautions such as ensuring patients bathe or shower before surgery, and the best way for surgical teams to clean their hands, guidance on when to use antibiotics to prevent infections, which sutures to use as well. Here in the U.S., surgically acquired infections cost about $1 billion a year and lead to an estimated 400,000 additional days spent in the hospital. Smoking kills about 6 million people worldwide, and now scientists may understand the pathology a bit better. A British study showed smoking a pack of cigarettes a day can cause up to 150 mutations per year in the average smoker's lung cells. While a majority of the damage is seen in the lungs, researchers noted cell damage and mutation in a number of other organs, which would explain how smokers often contract other kinds of cancers, including bladder, liver, and throat. Researchers said the findings show a direct link between the number of cigarettes smoked in a lifetime and the number of mutations in the DNA of cancerous tumors. Smoking has been linked with at least 17 types of cancer, but until now, scientists just weren't clear on the mechanisms behind many of them. Each mutation is a potential start point for a cascade of genetic damage that eventually can lead to cancer. If current trends continue, the World Health Organization predicts more than 1 billion tobacco-related deaths this century. Open enrollment is underway in the Obamacare insurance marketplaces in some parts of the country with low state participation and fewer insurance carriers. Rates have gone up 25% in some cases, whereas in other parts of the country, rates have remained relatively static. However, out-of-pocket costs continue to pose a challenge. An analysis by the Kaiser Family Foundation suggests those who are quite healthy, as well as those who will require a lot of healthcare services, might want to consider the cheapest bronze plans, which have a lower monthly premium than the more popular silver plans, but require more out-of-pocket costs to meet that deductible. Liar, liar, pants on fire, but how can we tell? Well, up till now, polygraph tests have been the standard tool for investigating whether someone is telling the truth or not. Turns out brain scans may be far more reliable determinants of someone's truth-telling or not. Study published in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry done at the Perelman School of Medicine at UPenn found scanning people's brains with fMRI or functional magnetic resonance imaging was significantly more effective at spotting lies than a traditional polygraph test. The approach adds significant data to the long-standing debate about this technology, building the case for more studies investigating its potential real-life applications. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Vindell Washington, the 6th National Coordinator for Health IT at the Department of Health and Human Services. He recently served as the Principal National Deputy Coordinator, where he assumed the executive leadership of all ONC programs and operations. Prior to that, Dr. Washington served as Chief Medical Information Officer and President of the Medical Group at Franciscan Missionaries of Our Lady Health System in Baton Rouge. He also served as CEO of Piedmont Healthcare Management Group in Charlotte, North Carolina, a fellow of the American College of Emergency Physicians. Dr. Washington served as captain in the U.S. Army, earned his bachelor's from Penn State, his master's science in healthcare management from Harvard, and his MD from the University of Virginia. Dr. Washington, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to have an opportunity to speak with you today.
You know, we've had some of your predecessors on over the last couple of years, Karen DeSalvo and Farzad Mostashari. And there's been such a dramatic transformation in the landscape since the office was created. Sort of, we were in the Luddite generation, now we're right in the techite generation. I mean, we've really come so far. But I'm wondering if you can help our listeners understand some of the significant strides that have been made in the past decade and how far we've really come.
I do think it's been just remarkable how far we've been able to come in healthcare IT and in the period of time since our office was started. To underscore maybe one series of items in particular, and I think that is around adoption. You could look at where we stood at the start of this era, and we've reached high heights now where we have 96% of hospitals that are using healthcare information technology and have electronic medical records. And about three quarters of doctors and physician offices are using certified health information technology. We had an increase of from about 9% in hospitals to that 96% and about 17% of physician offices. And it's just a dramatic change over that period of time.
Well, Dr. Washington, you were already in charge of much of the operational duties at ONC, maybe starting with the heaviest lift, delivery system reform. So the adoption of health IT underpins so much of the reform that's being envisioned at HHS, paving the way for more interoperable and more transparent health data in this shift to value-driven and coordinated care that we're all in search of. Spotlight for us, if you will, some of the persistent and future challenges you think you will face in your role as the national coordinator.
Well, there is still work to be done. I think what we focus on particularly is the flow of information between the current data sources in the health ecosystem and the areas where care is provided, but also areas where discoveries are made and guidelines are given, either through public health agencies or through NIH research institutions that provide the information that guides the provision of care. And then the third leg, which is this patient-generated health data, wearables, and information that happens with patients as individuals is important in both the discovery side of that triangle as well as the care delivery side of that triangle. And that free information flow, we think, is quite important. And we're focusing on strategies to make that information flow more freely between those points in the system.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about the HITECH Act, which was passed in 2009. to fund the necessary transition from paper to electronic. Our own health center and thousands of health centers across the country, people who care for the disenfranchised, the poor, benefited from this. And the secretary has the requirement to report back to Congress on the progress that's been made. And ONC just released this year's annual report. I wonder if you could tell us some of the significant findings in the latest report.
One of our goals was to lift all boats, that all would benefit from this transition from paper to electronic. And the first statistic that I sort of relayed around the adoption, particularly in hospitals, when we say that it's 90% of those facilities using information technology in the way that we would hope, we're talking across the entire spectrum. I think we're also trying to empower patients. This ability for patients to have access to their information, both as a tool of empowerment, also just to help increase the quality of care that they receive. We think of it in terms of patients' ability to view, download, and then subsequently transmit that information. Hospitals and health systems have the ability to allow patients to view this data electronically. About 9 in 10 have the ability for patients to view and download, and about 7 in 10 have the ability to view, download, and then subsequently transmit that information. And that is, again, for both direct patient care, but also for research or even to other family members to help aid them in the care that they receive. One of the things that we were trying to deliver to Congress from a message perspective is that there are some great strides in a relatively short period of time, even as we pivot to look at challenges and areas that we can do better in.
Well, you also, through your work and the work of your team, have identified just sort of the next 5 years going forward with your federal health IT strategic plan and also the shared nationwide interoperability roadmap. Shared nationwide interoperability roadmap is kind of a mouthful, but if anyone has ever experienced transitioning between levels of care, transitioning geography, having a ill family member that they are trying to coordinate the care from afar, they know exactly what that mouthful means. Perhaps you could highlight some of the details in the strategic plan relating to interoperability or just other key strategic goals that you think we can look in 2020 and say, yes, we were able to accomplish that.
Well, I think one of the things we think about is changing a single moving part does not get us the free information flow that we desire. We think about it in terms of what strategic pillars that need to be moved. And I think we've sort of boiled it down to three major ones that we lean in on. First may be the obvious one, and that's around the technical standards that are required to transmit data electronically. I would say that of the three, in some instances, that may be the easiest one for us to attack. Mm-hmm. There's work to be done in terms of settling on standards, but by and large, there are a lot of standards for data that have been invented, and it's more a matter of coalescing on standards that best meet use cases before us. I think the other two legs of that stool, the second being changing the business drivers that allows and supports the flow of information, and that information flow really is a key part of a business model as opposed to just a nice to have, is important. And we've done some work across our federal family to help move in that direction. Our work with CMS in particular, I would highlight. And then the third is probably the hardest, and that's this idea of changing the culture around exchange, making it a situation where patients expect their information to flow freely, where providers expect both to be asked to provide that information to patients and to provide it to others in the care continuum. And we break down some of the silos around competition and some of the other barriers to exchange that exist from a cultural perspective. Those three areas are the three that we think are most important to focus on to move us to our goal in 2020.
We're speaking today with Dr. Vindell Washington, National Coordinator for Health IT at the Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Washington, CMS recently issued the final rules for MACRA. That's not Macarena, but it is sort of a dance, right? It's the Medicare and CHIP Reauthorization Act, which ended this so-called doc fix, which was the sustainable growth rate dance that we had to endure every year, right? Mm-hmm. Few things earned as much bipartisan support than that did. But many of the medical professions complain of a still more regulations being foisted upon them. Could you share what you see as the strengths of MACRA, including the quality payment program rule, and perhaps some aspects that should be improved upon or at least perhaps better sold to the medical community?
I'll share a personal story. I was privileged to be president of a private practice medical group in North Carolina. You know, and as a member of that group, when we were in that 13-year window of the SGR, we would really, about this time of the year, actually, yep. about every end yep. of the year, we'd try to figure out how we were going to survive with a 20% cut
yep.
in our fees. And the second part of that exercise was to say, heck, who do we know that we could reach out to mm-hmm. in Congress or mm-hmm. in the state legislature to help us? I mean, it was a pretty anxiety-provoking time for us. And so I think there was a real burning platform, which underscores the point you were making in the question that there was bipartisan support because there was really work that needed to be done. There are a series of things that I think were particularly positive in the MACRA rollout itself. In the quality payment program, in particular the one that pertains to the information sharing that is in line with the work that ONC does, this idea of really having doctors with more flexibility to select the measures and look at how those measures fit their practice, the work of a hospital-based physician, the work of a family physician, the work of a specialist, all those require different technology support. And having one-size-fits-all approach, I think, was something that I'm happy that we were able to craft in the final rule. And I also think that this idea of switching to outcomes was a step forward, dramatically reducing the number of items that had to be reported on from meaningful use 3 to 5. Mm-hmm. And those 5 that remain are almost all sort of based on information sharing. We think that's a great move. And the idea then is to allow doctors and vendors and others to concentrate just more fully on delivering value to their patients and working on innovative ways to use technology to that point. I think we're still bullish on technology. That's one of the reasons that we try to make clear that in the alternate payment models, which even have less rigidity around the operations perspective, that they all require the use of technology to sort of put the stake in the ground that that's important, but allowing the market to figure out best solutions to drive the outcomes that we all want.
Well, Dr. Washington, another form of pain that we hear so much about from clinicians, and these are from people who are really quite facile and expert in the use of the electronic health record, our physicians, our nurse practitioners, our PAs, they experience the pain point of feeling that the EHR takes away from or diminishes their interaction with patients. And I think we've all seen the recent study showing the average clinician spends about 25% of their workday actually seeing patients and 40% of their time entering data into the electronic health system. And they feel that the electronic health record isn't enhancing their work, although I think there is a true appreciation that we can do much better performance improvement and quality improvement and monitoring than we ever did before. I understand ONC has launched an app challenge this year and that the goal is to develop systems that can enhance the healthcare provider's experience with health IT. You're calling this the ONC Provider User Experience Challenge. Tell us about this and how you think this is really going to make life easier.
Well, we're really bullish on this idea that technology can achieve its full promise of making the provider's life easier, making the patient's experience better, improving the health of the nation and wellness in the nation, to stimulate the market and put some small incentives out for folks to work in that space. What we were describing is really a two-tiered process. So as part of our certification rule for electronic health records, we have pushed for the required disclosure of the application programming interfaces or APIs that are kind of the keys to unlock the data that exists in transactional systems within electronic health records. But really the second part of that is to have vendors and those who make applications and even the EHR vendors themselves take advantage of this freer flow of data that present information to providers in a way that is more in their workflow, present information in a way perhaps that they're more used to dealing with technology and using things like the FHIR or Fast Hospital Interoperability Resources. Those kind of technology interfaces to present a user interface that more matches their use of technology and maybe on their smartphone or in other areas of their lives where they're quite facile. The technology should be an enabler and workflow should be considered when deploying technology. Some of those are a function of us making this change to a system that's more based on value and not volume. I think in the first phase of the deployment, most of the technology was deployed in a way that allowed people to document the elements currently required to show payers that you were doing a good job. As we make this pivot and we switch more to outcomes and we try to release the innovation a bit, I think it puts us in a different position for what patients and providers can do in that space. And so the concentration is on this higher level goal, which allows for more innovation. That's what we were hoping for, at least.
Well, whoever comes up with that solution should get a Nobel Prize because it is something that we're all looking forward to.
Bob Dylan can write a song about it.
That's right, he can. You have such a great job, and you know that, and you're in Catbird's seat, and the president has really laid out a lot of exciting new initiatives. He's got the Cancer Moonshot being led by the Vice President, Precision Medicine Initiative by Dr. Collins over at NIH, the Brain Initiative to map the human brain, the quest on both Zika as well as the opioid crisis. And all of this is going to be facilitated with a robust health information infrastructure, not completely ready for prime time, but a lot of the track's been laid down. And how are these mini initiatives affecting the pace of development for building the kind of infrastructure we need?
Well, I think you needed both parts of that puzzle to make us accelerate quickly. You needed a baseline of digital information, which we started this conversation talking about, and you needed a use case that made use of that information. And I really can't think of any time recently where we haven't had some discussions about those new initiatives that we haven't come back to this base discussion about interoperability. And so it was a necessary part of the infrastructure. So we maybe had a few genetic markers in the past that we talked about in clinical care, but that number is sort of moving up exponentially. And we are talking about both discoveries and treatments being based on even more and more genetic information. And so those require sometimes additional standards, additional security strategies. But at its base, we're talking about setting up trust frameworks and identity frameworks and nomenclature and developing a culture and business case that allows this information to flow. And we're quite excited about it. We think that, you know, as you look at medicine in the future, and I'm privileged and proud to have two daughters who are going to be graduating from med school next year, twins that are graduating from med school.
Congratulations. That's great.
Thank you. But I think the world, their world of medicine will in no way be the same world of medicine that I practiced in the past 20, 25 years or so. I think that these kinds of initiatives and the ability to harness the data that you were talking about, Mark, I think that really is going to be the new frontier in medicine. And I just can't wait to see what comes from the right use of this new resource.
So let's just take that future forward look. Can you give us a highlight of the agenda that you have moving forward on your personal wish list as you think of one day handing the reins over to your own successor?
Well, I think that just as we've talked about phases in development, I think information flow and the free flow of information so it's available when and where patients need it is the next phase. I actually think that phase has a few components to it. I think that will probably be one of the things that continues to take some time and attention from the next national coordinator. Now, we had some areas in the president's budget proposal that sort of outlined some of that activity. I think as we focus having good information flow and prohibiting information blocking, we think that more transparency on the IT side in terms of products and services and how they're rendered, really creating some environment so that you could best share IT practices across the spectrum, whether that is related to some of the cybersecurity work that we've been involved in recently, or even just a place to share best practices on usability and sort of more nuts and bolts and less threatening activity, we think are going to be important for the next national coordinator. And I really do believe that it's a great job and that whoever has the privilege of sitting in it and leading an ONC4 will have a vital role to play as we move forward in healthcare.
We've been speaking with Dr. Vindell Washington, National Coordinator for Health IT at the Department of Health and Human Services. You can learn more about their work by going to healthit.gov or following them on Twitter at ONC_healthit or at Vindell W. VINDELLW. Dr. Washington, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
I thank you.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
We hear a lot of the same claims over and over again, and one of the recurring themes about the Affordable Care Act is that it's a job killer. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump recently echoed those claims, saying that, quote, hiring is totally frozen and wages are being slashed. Nonpartisan experts predicted that the law would have little effect on employment, and now we can take a look at some hard numbers on what's happened since individuals were required to have insurance coverage or pay a tax penalty in 2014. First off, hiring isn't frozen. There were more than 5.4 million job openings in August, the most recent month on record, and that is down only slightly from the 15-year high of over 5.8 million also posted this year. And since December 2013, the economy has added 7.6 million jobs. As for wages, we turn to the Bureau of Labor Statistics measure of average weekly earnings for all workers. Average earnings were 4.4% higher in September than they were in December 2013, just before insurance on the ACA exchanges kicked in. That includes a gain of 0.8% in the most recent 12 months alone. So the evidence doesn't support the idea that the Affordable Care Act has frozen hiring or reduced wages. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Catherine Couch is a self-taught chef with a love of organic foods and a penchant for helping people in need. After launching her own meal delivery service in Northern California, she often encountered a particular kind of client, someone battling a serious illness who was just too tired or too sick to prepare nutritious food just when they needed it most.
And especially for cancer patients, you also don't feel like eating. And so food, at the moment when it needs to be really, really important for many people, drops to the bottom of the priority list for a whole host of reasons. And on the other side, we're raising a generation of young people that don't know how to prepare food and don't understand the power that food has in their own life, but also for the life of the community and for the environment.
Couch is driven by the idea that food is medicine. When a friend asked if she would employ her teenage daughter in her kitchen for a summer, she stumbled on a way to grow her enterprise, hire teenage workers, use professional chefs to train them to cook healthy meals with organic ingredients, and place the power of healing with food into their hands. She launched the Ceres Project, named after the goddess of agriculture and fertility. She expanded her kitchen facilities and started hiring dozens of local teenagers, many of whom had never cooked or held a job. And she says the transformation in these kids is just amazing.
They walk into a situation where people are being the best of who they can be. They're invited into that. They're given an opportunity to make a real difference in someone's life. We have this rich resource in our community of teenagers who are actually longing to be given real opportunities to contribute. So it's a win-win on all those levels. And at the same time, they're all learning how to cook and eat healthy food.
Couch has since grown her enterprise from her home base in Sonoma County, and she has been contacted by interested organizations around the country that seek to replicate the program and expand it to multiple regions. The Ceres Project earned Couch a CNN Heroes Award. But the real reward, she says, she experiences in everyday encounters, in the hundreds of teens that she's trained and in the thousands of clients that they have served healthy meals to during a time of need.
We do a block where clients come in every day and sit with the kids and talk about what it was like to be diagnosed and what their journey has been like as they've been sick and the difference that the food has made for them. And it includes sometimes people who know they're terminal. It includes sometimes partners who've lost their partner, who come in and talk about the difference that the kids made for their partner at the end stage of life. And there's a lot of tears that happen in that room, and it's very profound.
A program that trains young people in the art of healthy cooking, using those skills to feed those suffering from serious illness who might otherwise face malnutrition, empowering empathy in the kids, these are all bright ideas. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at wesufm.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.